Our discussion this hour gives us a chance to think beyond the concerns of the moment. I mean, way beyond the concerns of the moment, because we'll be talking about the fate of the universe, the entire universe, the whole kit and caboodle. If there was indeed a big bang, there's going to be a big something at the other end, right? The answer to that question takes some time and patience, and Katie Mack brings both, plus a sense of humor, to her new book, The End of Everything, Astrophysically Speaking. Katie Mack is a theoretical astrophysicist and assistant professor of physics at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. She's a columnist for Cosmos magazine and has been published in Scientific American and Time, among others. Dr. Mack, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. When you began to talk about the fate of the Earth itself, it reminded me when I was about six or seven and I first learned about the sun turning into a red giant and burning the planet to a crisp and then receding to a white dwarf and turning us into an iceberg. It really bothered me, even though it was 5 billion years away. So how far away is the end of the universe, to put this all in perspective?
Well, it depends on which way it goes. And in my book, I talk about five different possibilities. But we're talking, generally speaking, trillions and trillions and trillions of years. It's not anytime soon. But it is interesting. You know, I hear a lot of people say that when they hear that the sun is going to die, it's a traumatic thing, because just because you expect these things to be eternal, and the idea that they're not is really troubling.
It sounds like you had a moment like that with Professor Finney, as you describe in the book. Tell us what he laid out and how you responded.
Well, so that was a time when I was in college, and there was this sort of seminar class where we would go to the homes of the professors who would tell us about their work in a sort of informal setting. And during one of these events, Professor Cyril Finney, who is one of the astronomy professors, was talking about cosmic inflation, this very sudden, extreme stretching of the cosmos in the early universe, and pointing out that we don't know why it happened, we don't know why it started or why it stopped, we don't understand the mechanics of that, and so we don't really know for sure that something as violent as that couldn't happen right now in the cosmos. You know, we don't have any assurance that that our current sort of slow and gentle cosmic evolution can't be totally upended by something weird. And that was definitely a moment that stuck in my mind, because it was the first time I really thought of the cosmos as being something that wasn't just stable and eternal and you know, habitable all the time.
So are cosmologists the people who tell the astronomers to enjoy it, it'll be gone someday?
Cosmologists are people who work in astronomy or physics thinking about the really big, large-scale questions. So things like how the universe began, how it ended, how it will end, the evolution of the cosmos as a whole, what's in it, how the physics of the cosmos works. So it really is kind of the larger-scale picture that cosmologists work on.
You know, you said how it ended, but that's not necessarily mutually exclusive here. I mean, the universe could have ended already and been recreated, couldn't it?
Yeah. So there are possibilities that the universe has cycles, and that the our Big Bang was the end of the previous cycle. So that's something that I also talk about in the book. There are several theories of cosmology where there can be a big bang and then a big crunch and so on and so forth in a cycle eternally. And you can also have other kinds of evolutions where the current universe will evolve in some way. It'll keep expanding for a while. Something else will happen, and then it'll start a new cycle in some part of the universe or as in the universe as a whole. So that's certainly an option. But in even all of those scenarios, the part of the universe that we're in, the kind of observable universe, does end in the sense that everything in it is destroyed. So even though there could be some renewal, it's not looking great for our part of the universe, our sort of the part of the universe we can contact being eternal in any sense.
Our part of the universe, because it's observable, it's what we know, we can see, and we know that there are some problems here.
It's just that we know what's going on in our part of the universe, and we see how it's evolving. So our observable universe is this volume of space that we can detect with telescopes, that we can observe there's a region beyond that that we can't observe, just because it's so far away that basically the light would take too long to get to us. And because light takes some time to travel, any place so far away that light would take more than the age of the universe to get to us, we can't see that part of the universe. So we're pretty sure there's more universe out there, and we don't know that the evolution of those parts of the universe are the same. You know, so there could be other kinds of processes happening beyond our cosmic horizon, beyond the part of the universe we can observe. But for the part we can observe, we know how it's been evolving over time. We know that it started with a Big Bang, and it's been expanding, and so we can extrapolate into the future. And there's no way that that the evolution that we're on is one that that just leaves everything kind of nice and normal forever. There's going to be big changes, and it's going to really alter the structure of the cosmos.
So within our observable part of the universe, I mean, are the rules fairly consistent? I mean, are we the things that you say that we know about it and the processes, or does it seem like what happens here, what, you know, is what happens out at the end of what our telescopes can reach?
Yeah, you know, we have a principle in cosmology called the cosmological principle, which is just this idea that the universe is pretty much the same everywhere, at least everywhere we can see. So our part of the universe is not particularly special. There's nothing unique about our region of space. If you look billions of light years away, you still have galaxies that look very much like the galaxies nearby. You still have the kind of structure of where things are laid out, how matter and energy are balanced and all that. It's very similar everywhere in the cosmos. And that's helpful because it means that we can look at very distant things and therefore look back into the past. Because when you look at something far away, the light took so long to get to you that you're looking very far into the past. And so we can see parts of the universe that are so far away that they're in sort of early stages of the universe. And we can say, well, if that's what the early universe looks like in that part of the cosmos, it's probably what it looks like here too. So we can make inferences about what our cosmic region looks like billions of years ago.
It sounds like you committed fairly early to this career, Katie. Is it true 10 years old when you started down this trail?
Yeah, pretty much. That was around the time I started to learn about things like black holes and the Big Bang and space-time. And, you know, at the time, those were just mind-bending ideas to me. I didn't really understand how all that stuff worked, but I wanted to dig into that. I wanted to get a better feeling for how these strange processes might happen in the universe. And so I read A Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking, and I found out that he's called the cosmologist, so therefore I want to be a cosmologist. That's the path I want to go on. And so I just continued from there.
So how hard do we differentiate between theoretical cosmologists like yourself and whatever the other kind is called?
Well, so as a theorist, I don't use telescopes and I don't do experiments. So that's the main difference. I don't work with data. I work mostly with equations and computer programs. And I use the discoveries that people have made with telescopes and experiments about what the data are telling us. And then I use that information and try and figure out what we could learn with new experiments, with new observations, and what the current theories tell us about how things might have happened in the early universe, how things might happen in the future, and so on.
How does learning about the end help us while it's all still running?
Well, there are a few things that I would say are important to think about this. One thing is that we're just curious. You know, we want to understand the universe, and thinking about where we're headed is, I think, something that everybody can relate to, wanting to understand, you know, what's going to happen next, what's our fate. I think that's just a point of human curiosity. But in terms of physics, it's also sometimes very helpful to take the theory and think about what it predicts into the future and sort of how the consequences would play out, because it allows you to examine the theory in a different way, to maybe figure out inconsistencies in it or consequences of the model that may or may not work with what you think is the data are telling you. So it's kind of a useful way to put your theory or your model through the paces and stretch it to its limits. So it can be useful as an exercise just to understand the physics that we're already talking about.
In a way, is it like drawing trend lines and figuring out if these processes continue to happen in the universe, then the universe ends because of X?
Yeah. I mean, it's about extrapolating and, you know, figuring out the consequences of the kind of predictions you're making right now. And sometimes that'll lead you to something that looks totally absurd. Sometimes it'll lead you to something really interesting and intriguing. And that might give you some insight into kind of the structure of physics and the theory that you're looking at.
So I you can correct me on this if I'm wrong. I can't imagine there was a lot of warning for the Big Bang. So is it possible that what comes at the other end could also happen suddenly?
Sure, yeah. There are a few possibilities that that are unpredictable in the sense of we wouldn't know they were coming. We wouldn't know when they would happen. There's a lot we don't understand about the universe. There's a lot we don't understand about what we know is in the universe right now. So we know that the universe only a small fraction of what the universe is made of is the kind of matter that we can see and understand and touch and everything. So regular matter, the stuff we're made of, planets are made of, stars, that's only something like 4 or 5% of what the universe is made of. There's also dark matter, which is this invisible stuff that seems to hold galaxies together, and it's the gravity that kind of pulls everything in, and that's maybe around 20-25% of the universe. And then the rest is dark energy, which is something even more mysterious that seems to just make the universe expand faster, and we don't know what that is. And so because there are all these uncertainties, it's very hard to make solid predictions about what's going to happen next. We don't know if dark energy might change how it's acting to expand the universe. And there are other uncertainties around particle physics. One of the ideas I talk about in the book is vacuum decay, where something from particle physics could create a sort of instability in how physics works that could drastically rewrite the laws of physics in the universe in a way that would be unsurvivable for us. And that's one of the things that could happen very suddenly.
Right. That is one of the five choices. Big crunch, heat death, big rip, vacuum decay, and bounce. In the end of everything, astrophysically speaking, by Katie Mack, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. So let's come back to the Big Bang and give us a little refresher course there. The dense Big Bang. What was that?
Yeah. So what we know about the Big Bang, when we talk about the Big Bang as physicists or cosmologists, what we're really talking about is the idea that the early universe, you know, 13.8 billion years ago, the universe was hot and dense and in some sense smaller than it is today. So the Big Bang theory is just that idea that there was a hot, dense universe. And the reason we think that is that we see that the universe is currently expanding. Galaxies are getting farther apart from each other. And we can kind of dial that expansion back and we see that everything was much closer together, much denser in the past. And we can also see very strong evidence of that from actually just looking out into the universe, because if you look farther away and you're therefore looking back in time, there's a point where you can look so far away that you're looking back in time all the way to the time when the universe was this hot, dense, kind of plasma-filled space, right? So there are parts of the universe that are so far away from us that we look at them and they're so far back in time that they're still kind of in that primordial fire state of the Big Bang when space itself was glowing with heat. And so we can see that light directly from that time. And that tells us that the universe really was in this hot, dense state and that it has been evolving, you know, and cooling and expanding since that time. And so we learn a lot about the conditions of the early universe because we can really directly see them.
But it's interesting. So that they still maintain some characteristics from the hot, dense state, but they've been flung a long way, I would think. And over that time and space, they haven't. Of course, we're looking at the light from a long time ago. This is where my brain starts to hurt.
It's very counterintuitive. So the Big Bang is not something that happened in one spot. A lot of times people think of it as an explosion of a single point into a larger space. And that's not how we think it happened. We think that the whole universe was much denser and, you know, hotter. Like, so it might have been infinite in extent, but it was hot and dense and, you know, in some sense smaller. Even if it was infinite, it's still infinite, you know, it was less infinite in some weird way at the time. So the whole universe was hot and dense, which means that if we look far enough away, we're looking at parts of the universe that are very far from us and also from our perspective, very far in the past. And so some very distant point, was we can see it as it was in that hot, dense state. So even though, you know, even though right now that part of the universe might be, you know, cool and diffuse the same way the far part of the universe is, we can't see it as it is now, but we can see it as it was when it was hot and dense at the same time we were hot and dense way back 13.8 billion years ago.
Katie, do we think about the Big Bang as having to obey the laws of physics as we know them, or did the Big Bang create those laws?
Well, that gets into a lot of questions about sort of what we think really happened at that time. There was a time in the early universe that where we know the laws of physics were different than they are today. So it turns out that the laws of physics are kind of temperature dependent. So if you're in a very, very energetic, very hot kind of environment, the laws of physics are different. And there was a time when the early universe was so hot and dense that the laws of physics were different. And we can predict that, and we can also make measurements of that in sort of indirect ways by colliding particles together to reach those energies and temperatures and see what physics looks like in those situations. So we know that the laws of physics have changed in the sense that sort of the structure of physical law, the mix of particles and how they interact with each other, those were different in the first kind of microseconds of the universe than they are now. But there are certain things that we think probably kind of stay constant all the time. We're trying to better understand our theories and the kind of bigger picture of physics to try to put together a theory that can explain both that early dense state and the current state of physics and kind of wrap everything up together. But we're still sort of working out how it all fits together at the very, very, very earliest moments.
We're kind of racing through a few billion years of history here on the Jefferson Exchange with Katie Mack, an astrophysicist, a theoretical astrophysicist. Her book is called The End of Everything, Astrophysically Speaking, and it lays out five possible scenarios for the end of the universe, but with a sense of humor, and it's written for a general audience. And you can join the conversation here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Before we go too much further, I need to ask about the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, and how important that is in understanding the Big Bang and what's happened since.
Right. So I mentioned before that we can see parts of the universe that, from our perspective, are still in that early fireball stage. And so when we look at the very distant universe, we see this light coming to us from every direction, this glow from when the universe was hot and dense. And that's really the afterglow of the Big Bang. And we call that the cosmic microwave background. It's called microwave because the kind of radiation it is, the light has been kind of stretched out so that it's in the microwave part of the electromagnetic spectrum. So microwaves are just another kind of radiation, like visible light, but longer wavelength. And so we see this microwave background light, this light from the Big Bang, and we can map it out. We can see how it's a little bit hotter, or, you know, sort of a slightly different color of microwaves in some places and a slightly different color in other places. And we can use that information to figure out how the matter was distributed throughout the universe in that early fireball stage. And then we can put that information into our computers and figure out how that kind of early universe would evolve into the universe we see today. So we learn a lot about cosmic evolution, about what was existing in the universe at that time and what exists in the universe now, by being able to see that kind of baby picture of the cosmos.
You know, I have to admit that my brain kind of went to the what goes up must come down kind of looking at things. And you do eventually get there yourself, the idea that if something creates and flings out at some point, it'll have to come back. Is this one of the essences of what we're talking about at the end of the universe?
Well, yeah, that's a question that's been part of the what we've been trying to figure out in cosmology for a long time. The universe is currently expanding. Is that expansion going to stop and turn around the same way that if you throw a ball up into the air, it stops and falls back down? It's very similar physics, really. There's, you know, there was a Big Bang, and you can think of that as sort of the push when you throw a ball up into the air, and that gave the universe some expansion. And then there's the gravity of all the stuff in the universe that kind of wants to slow that expansion down and pull everything back. And the question has been, was that initial Big Bang push violent enough that there's just, you know, there's so much expansion that the gravity can't slow it down enough to stop it? Or is there enough gravity, enough stuff in the universe that the expansion will stop and reverse? And that was a big question in, you know, up until sort of the mid to late 90s, when we started to be able to measure the past history of the expansion. And we're trying to figure out, you know, how much is this expansion slowing down? Is it going to slow down enough to stop? And what we found out at that time was the expansion wasn't slowing down at all. It was actually speeding up. And that's why we had to introduce this new idea of the universe that there's this dark energy, there's something that's making the expansion happen, you know, accelerate, go faster. In the same way that if you throw a ball up into the air and it sort of slows down for a little while and then just shoots off into space. There's something in the cosmos that is starting to speed up the expansion of the universe, even though it was slowing down for the first, you know, 9-ish billion years. Now it's speeding up, and we don't really understand what's doing that, but we call that dark energy.
And that could be up to 76% of the universe?
Yeah. It's a big fraction of what the universe is made of, if you count by, you know, energy budget or whatever, like how much sort of stuff there is. It's most of the universe. It dominates how the universe evolves now, and we don't know what it is.
Let's see, we have a couple of contacts from listeners here. An anonymous phone call wants to know if it's possible to figure out where everything came from. Did it come from nothing? Do light and dark matter have the same source?
Yeah, that's another question that we're trying to figure out. You know, we know that the universe was hot and dense early on. We think that before that hot, dense state, there was a kind of a very rapid expansion called inflation that made the universe stretch out very rapidly at the beginning. And when that inflationary period ended, we think that there was a process there that created all the particles, all the matter and stuff that's in the universe. And so in that scenario, probably the dark matter and the regular matter all came out of that initial sort of ending of the inflationary stage. But right now I'm kind of waving my hands around a lot because there's a lot there that we don't understand yet, that we're trying to figure out exactly what happened with inflation, how it started, how it ended, if it even did happen. You know, I talk a lot in the book about possibilities for alternatives to that as well. So we really don't know, and we don't know what started that whole process. We don't know if there was a singularity before inflation where everything was infinitely dense. You know, we don't know if that happened or not. So there's a lot of uncertainty around this very, very, very early stage. But you know, I don't want to sell it short. We do understand a lot of what happened down to, like, you know, less than a microsecond after whatever the beginning was. And we have very strong evidence for that. So there's a little bit we don't understand at the very, very beginning, but we have a pretty good idea of what happened after that.
So to each of the theories, the five theories extant that you put in the book, the Big Crunch comes first. Is this basically the opposite of the Big Bang, that we all come back to a very hot, dense state?
Yeah, this is the idea that the expansion. Well, yeah, whatever's left. The idea is the expansion could stop and turn around and everything could come back. Now, again, we don't think that that's as likely now, because we know that the universe is accelerating in its expansion, and so it's hard to see how it would stop and reverse. But we also don't know what dark energy is, why the acceleration is happening. So it's possible that there's some aspect of whatever's causing the current acceleration that could change its operation and cause things to collapse again. So the Big Crunch would be any scenario where the expansion of the universe stops, reverses, and everything comes crashing back together and goes it back into that hot, dense state.
Okay, so this has been this is not one of the ones that really is popular among the pantheon of possible ends.
Yeah. These days, it's not as popular. There was a time in sort of the 60s when everybody thought that's what was going to happen.
Okay. Well, we have yet to talk about heat death, the Big Rip, vacuum decay, and bounce. And I wrote a question mark, bounce. As we go to the break, we have an email, not an email, but a phone drop-off from Bill in Sutherland, who would rather not even focus on this. He says, we're killing each other and the planet at such a vicious rate that the end of the universe is not a situation we should currently be focused on and worried about. We'll get some response from Katie on that. I want to get response first, though, to what Bill and Sutherland called in about, the idea that, hey, we got to worry about what's on the Earth right now. The end of time can wait for the end of time or something.
Sure. I mean, I certainly don't think we should be worrying about the end of time, but I do think that we as humans are just are curious creatures, you know, and part of what defines humanity is that we want to understand our larger context. We want to understand where we came from and where we're going. And I think that we should pursue that curiosity, even if things are very bad in our current situation in whatever way. I think that it can be very inspiring. It can be very helpful to think about the bigger picture in a cosmic sense. I think that it's something that sort of defines our humanity, that we want to know these answers to these big questions. One of the things that I think about a lot is something called the overview effect, where astronauts, after they go off into space and they see the Earth from above, they often come back saying that they think about the Earth as being more connected and humanity as being more connected to themselves, to each other, and it inspires them to see our common goal and our common good and to understand the fragility of the planet we live on, and that inspires them to be more kind to one another. And I think that that's something that we can get out of thinking about cosmology and thinking about these big questions and our place in the cosmos, is to understand that, you know, we should make the most of the time we have, and we're really all in this together.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move on to talk about heat death, one of the five, I'm not going to call them options, but possibilities for the end of the universe as currently
sure.
envisioned. What is the genesis or the basic thrust of this this theory?
So the heat death is the one that seems most likely at the moment, and it's the idea that the current expansion that we're experiencing is going to continue and continue to accelerate over time. And that means that galaxies will get farther apart from each other. There'll be fewer interactions. There'll be fewer stars being formed. And over time, the stars that are here will start to burn out, and everything will get kind of more diffuse and darker and sort of colder and lonelier. And in the end, there will just be this sort of basically empty cosmos where all of the matter will have decayed. And there will be just a tiny amount of kind of trace heat left over from all of the processes that ever occurred in the cosmos. It's kind of a sad way to go, just sort of fading out into the darkness. But that seems to be where the way things are headed right now because of the current expansion of the universe.
There was one part of the chapter on heat death that really kind of gave me a brain cramp, and it was about the idea mm-hmm. that things that are further away are bigger, or it was something. It confused me because
yeah.
if light speed is a constant and things were once closer, it seems counterintuitive.
So there's this weird thing that happens in an expanding universe where, you know, for the most part, when you look at something far away, it looks smaller than it would have if it were closer to you. That's what's normal. But if the universe has been expanding over time since the beginning, you can get a situation where that stops being true, and at some distance, things farther away actually look bigger. The reason for that is that their light left that point so long ago that when the light left that point was actually closer to you because the universe has been expanding. And so there are galaxies we can see that are, you know, shining, and the image we see of them was kind of sent to us when they were much closer to us than they are now, and so they look bigger on the sky. So there's this strange thing that happens with distance and size that kind of blows my mind, too. It's something I love to talk about because it's just so weird.
Okay, a couple more contacts from listeners. Steve in Grants Pass dropped off by phone. This, we all know the universe is infinite. Does Dr. Mack have any ideas about what is on the other side of the universe? Also, have there been studies done at the molecular level that compare the further reaches of the universe with the universe we expect in space? If so, what are the similarities or differences? So a bit packed in there, but thanks for that, Steve.
So we don't know for sure that the universe is infinite. We often assume that. We do have reason to believe that it's very similar everywhere, that we don't see any evidence for an edge or or a change in the cosmos from one part to another. And there have been studies trying to measure whether the laws of physics are the same, the constants of nature, whether those are the same here and in very, very distant reaches of the cosmos. And so far, we don't have any evidence that there is a big change. It seems like things, you know, atomic physics and so on, pretty much works the same here as it does in the farthest reaches of the cosmos that we can observe. But as for whether it goes on forever, we don't really know, because we can only see out to a certain distance. And beyond that, we're not sure what's there.
All right. And a couple of emails here. One from Ken in Grants Pass, who writes, how might the evolution of the universe be influencing Earth on the scale of age of the Earth and the Holocene, the last 10,000 years? That from Ken in Grants Pass. Thanks, Ken.
I think that the evolution of the cosmos over that amount of time, you know, the Earth has been around for sort of like 4.5 billion years or so. And the cosmos has changed a lot in the last 4.5 billion years, but that change won't really have affected the way the Earth is sort of existing, because the Earth is much more influenced by, you know, the sun and the stuff in the solar system than what's going on in the larger picture of the cosmos. The background light was a bit hotter when the Earth was formed than it is now, but that probably didn't make a huge difference. The only thing that could have been different is that the amount of cosmic radiation, you know, cosmic rays, high-energy particles from space, that would have been a little bit higher early in the Earth's history, but probably not enough to make a huge difference in how things were developing here.
And then an email from Louise in Applegate, who writes, could the problem with finding a unified theory be that when we look at the macrocosm, we're looking into the past and trying to examine the microcosm, and the quantum world, we're faced with probability and therefore looking into the future? Louise, thanks for that.
Well, there certainly is an issue with trying to find unified theories where we have this disconnect between how we understand the big picture universe, which is governed mostly by gravity, and how we understand the quantum world, which is governed by quantum mechanics. So when we think about particle physics, we're dealing with quantum mechanics. When we look out into the cosmos on the large scales, we're dealing mostly with gravity, with general relativity, Einstein's theory. And we know that those two theories don't fit together well. But one of the other things we can do when we look out into the cosmos is examine the very early universe. And we do think that in the early universe, both gravity and quantum mechanics were important in interesting ways. So we're hoping that by doing cosmology, by thinking and looking at the early universe, we can learn something about how those theories can fit together.
All right. So I want to make sure we get the theories all at least touched upon. The big rip, is this something like the preferred alternative, the most likely deemed scenario, at least at the moment?
I'm not sure that it's that preferred. It's an idea that is based on the fact that we don't understand dark energy, and we don't know for sure that dark energy is going to keep going the way it's going right now. So dark energy is whatever's making the universe expand faster. It could be that dark energy is this stuff that changes over time, and it could be changing in a way that it'll get sort of more powerful. And if that happens, then it can kind of rip things apart instead of just moving them farther apart as the expansion of the universe is doing now. It can actually kind of get into galaxies and rip galaxies apart, rip stars away from their planets and so on. That's the idea behind what so-called phantom dark energy that would lead to a big rip. I don't think it's preferred in the theoretical sense. A lot of theorists would say that it's not a good theory, but in terms of the observation, we can't really rule it out. We can say that if the big rip is happening, it's not happening soon, but we can't say for sure that it won't happen.
Okay. So, all right. Here again, one of the major parts of this is that when we talk about dark energy, is that things are accelerating at the edge of the universe. It's not like they hit a constant and kept going. They're actually picking up speed.
Yeah, the expansion of the universe is speeding up. We know that, like, there's no real edge of the universe in the sense that things just keep going forever, as far as we can tell. But when we look at very distant objects, they're moving faster. And the way that the expansion of the universe has been evolving over time, it's getting faster and faster now than it was before. And that really is weird. And we call it dark energy, whatever's making that happen. But we don't really understand why it's happening or what's making it do that.
Okay, the discussion of the edge of the universe is a good place to bring in Skeeter in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Katie Mack, the author of The End of Everything.
Hiya, fascinating program, thank you. I saw the movie Powers of 10 years ago, and it really made me sort of think about a Mobius strip, if you know what I'm talking about, where you get a piece of paper, twist it one time, and connect it. And you might have answered it a moment ago, but I'm wondering somehow if the way out, looking way out there, and looking way in down to the atomic level, and you might have answered it a moment ago, but I've been fascinated ever since I saw that movie, wondering if the macro and the micro ultimately are connected somewhere.
All right.
Thank you.
Excellent question. Thanks for that, Skeeter.
Thanks. Yeah, that is an interesting question, and there are some discussions in string theory about possible connections between length scales, you know, sizes, things happening on large scales versus things happening on small scales. We don't really know at the moment how to connect the physics on the largest scales to the physics on the smallest scales, but we do know that we can learn about one by studying the other. So we definitely do learn things about particle physics by studying the cosmos, and vice versa. And that's one of the things that I find so exciting about this field is that there are ways to make connections between the smallest scales and the largest scales in terms of understanding how physics works everywhere in the universe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's vacuum decay. What's the basis of this theory?
So vacuum decay is this idea that maybe the universe is not quite as stable as we thought. So there's some set of laws of physics in the universe, sort of the structure of physical law, and it's possible that there's another option for the way that physics is organized. There's something else that kind of fits all the equations just as well. And if that's true, then that might be that other organization of physics, that other set of physical laws might in some sense be preferred by the universe. And what that would mean is that it's possible that somewhere in the universe could kind of revert to that other state. The physical laws could change in one point in the universe and create a bubble of a different kind of space where with different physical laws that could expand through the universe and destroy everything. And this would be a very sudden transition that this bubble would expand at the speed of light, roughly, and it would be a very sort of violent occurrence. And it's something that physicists have been talking about a lot in the last few years, based on getting a better understanding of particle physics. So we're not sure if it could happen. It probably wouldn't happen anytime soon, but it's a cool sort of new, interesting possibility.
And then that finally brings us to the bounce, the last of the five theories you put in the book for the end of the universe. And what is that?
Yeah, so bouncing cosmologies are a sort of category of cosmological theories where the universe goes in a cycle from Big Bang to Big Crunch or some kind of evolution that goes from a beginning to an ending and then a new beginning. And there are a lot of different possibilities for that. Some of the ones I talk about in the universe involve kind of higher dimensional spaces crashing into each other and creating new Big Bangs that way, or a kind of Big Crunch scenario or just a small contraction that leads to a new Big Bang. So there are a few ways that it can happen, but there are some very interesting theories being developed now that would imply this kind of cyclic cosmology.
Well, and in fact, the Big Bang wasn't even the prevailing theory, I guess, 100 years ago, even more recently than that. So, I mean, how much just over the course of your career, Katie, have the ideas for the end of it all evolved?
There's been an interesting sort of shift in ideas. When dark energy was discovered, when the accelerated expansion of the universe was discovered, that really did change the way we think about the end of the universe and the future evolution of the cosmos. And then these cyclic cosmologies have mostly come about in the last decade or two, and those are very interesting as well as alternatives to the physics that we think about for the early universe as well as the end of the universe. So there are a lot of changing ideas, but in terms of the observations, you know, we've known since the 60s that there was this hot, dense state early on because we've been able to see that cosmic microwave background radiation. So from that perspective, that story has not been changing. But the idea of the future has been shifting around quite a lot in interesting ways.
There's, you know, I mentioned already, there's quite a bit of sense of humor in the book. It is very accessible. I mean, you'll get your brain a good stretching if you haven't gotten into the thinking cosmologically before now. But it's also some serious thinking in the epilogue about humans and humanity and whether anything we're doing now will be remembered or even possible to remember in the far future.
Yeah. It's one of the things that, as I was writing the book, I was thinking a lot about what does this really mean for us as humans if the universe is going to end someday? Do we have a legacy? Is there meaning in a cosmos that's fated to end? And so I went around and asked a bunch of my colleagues what they think about it, how they feel about the end of the universe. And it was really fascinating to hear different perspectives on whether people are okay with it, the universe is going to end, or maybe have some idea of how maybe it could live on, maybe some piece of information could carry on into a new cycle of the universe, and maybe that's a comforting thought. It's something I'm still trying to figure out how I feel about, honestly.
Well, it's certainly intriguing to think about the idea of a universe, our universe, going away completely and maybe another one replacing it and just starting all over again. Your brain will get that kind of a stretching in the book. It is called The End of Everything, Astrophysically Speaking. It's by Katie Mack at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Katie, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me. It was a fun conversation.
All right, take care.